Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation.
We're going to start out talking about epigenetics, mysteries of epigenetics, and included in that is an odd pivot to one of my favorite topics, which is, of course, the microbiome. Nope, it wasn't genetics this time, but let's just say that this particular story combines two of my favorite things, and also one of my least favorite things. So starting with the least favorite, well, that would be cancer. And there are rising rates of early onset bowel cancer, not just in the United States, we've talked about that before, but actually worldwide. And the numbers are startling. Compared with Americans born around 1950, projections suggest that those born around 1990 are twice as likely to develop colon cancer by the time they turn 50. And four times as likely to develop rectal cancer. And this trend appears to be worsening, with each generation having a greater risk than its predecessors. And similar patterns have been reported in at least 27 other countries. Basically, anyone who's doing the statistics is seeing the same trends. Observational studies have looked at this and pointed to a variety of non-hereditary factors, including obesity, alcohol intake, low physical activity. But new genomic methods could change that. And these methods are what allow scientists to identify something called a mutational signature. Distinct changes that are induced in a cell's genome by specific external influences, that is to say, epigenetic. For example, tobacco is an external influence, so is radiation. If the same mutation brought about in the same way occurs in enough people with early onset cancer, then a case could be made that the culprit's been found. And a paper published in Nature in April 23rd of this year suggests that exactly such a breakthrough may in fact have been found. The paper is called Geographic and Age Variations in Mutational Processes in Colorectal Cancer. One of the authors is Alexandrov, and all I needed to do was put that title in, and Alexandrov, D-R-O-V, and it popped right up in my browser. What this paper suggests is that exposure to a common gut bacteria early in childhood may contribute to premature bowel cancer. It's not just that bacteria, it's a specific strain of that bacteria. So when the researchers started looking at the genomes, and they looked at the genomes of 981 colorectal cancer tumors from 11 different countries, and the most common mutational signature they found was that of something called colibactin, which is a toxin that's released by a number of bacteria. It was present in more than 50% of the tumors from patients younger than age 40, but less than 20% of the tumors of those over age 60. The interesting thing about this is on investigation, the damage from the colibactin occurred in the very early stages of tumor development, as well as in the specific gene whose impairment triggers bowel cancer. And we'll be talking more about that APC gene a little later in this story. When they went on to analyze stool samples that had been collected from children in 20 countries for a prior study, they discovered that those from countries with the higher rates of early onset cancer were more likely to carry a particular colibactin-producing strain of E. coli. Now, Why this should be the case is not clear, but certain suggestions come to mind. The rising rates of antibiotic use over that period of time between 1950 and the present day, 40 years to 1990, and the rising rates of cesarean delivery, which we know disrupts the child's microbiomes. This could allow this strain of E. coli to take root because of the absence of protective bacteria, which would be received during passage through the vaginal canal in a normal, spontaneous vaginal delivery. Now, normally we think of cancers happening over the series of several decades. It's a buildup of multiple mutations that start to pile up on each other. But these early colibacterin mutations follow a different script. That's because they actually hit a extremely important controlling gene that is the growth control gene in the first place. So if you get a hit at this first cancer driver gene at, say, the age of 5, you essentially become 20 to 30 years ahead of schedule for getting your colorectal cancer. It's not just colibacterin. The researchers also found two other mutational signatures which affected cancer genes and were also widespread in younger patients. Whereas 50% of the early cancer cases had the signature for colibacterin, 7 or 80% of them had some combination of these three genes. And the two new signatures aren't named here, and they're working, I'm sure, on identifying those. But the colibacterin has been investigated a bit further. An animal study published in the same month in Nature Microbiology revealed that these bacteria actually did very well, the E. coli that produce colibacterin, that is, do very well in mice fed a diet that's low in complex carbohydrates and soluble fiber. These mice essentially were following more of a standard American diet with higher levels of animal fat. What they found is that lack of fiber, which is, of course, the food for your good gut bacteria, appeared to weaken the mucosal barrier of the colon. The good bacteria essentially are starved. They are overtaken by the pathogenic bacteria that destroy that protective layer, and that exposes the colon cells to this mutagenic chemical, colibacterin. Another study done in Harvard and published in 2022 looked at doctors or health professionals, could have been nurses as well, they don't say, and they looked at their diets, and those who had the diets higher in red meat, processed meat, sugar, and refined grains, and low on fiber were also associated with colorectal tumors that contained greater amounts of colibacterin producing E. coli. Now, microplastics may be playing a role here. They've been recently shown to interfere with the protective barrier. But this colibacterin thing also opens up the idea for treatment, drugs that inhibit its effects, probiotics that might help protect against the proliferation of this E. coli, and bespoke bacteria infecting viruses known as phages. So essentially go in there after the C-section and take out all of the E. coli that makes colibacterin, just clean it out of the colon and let the other more beneficial probiotics thrive in the resulting vacuum, so to speak. The researchers are looking more carefully at these stool samples from the 20 country studies, trying to identify more information. Ideally, if we can come up with the exact strains of bacteria, we can do a probe for those, and we could screen individuals early in their childhood or young adulthood, identify those who are at higher risk, and do more surveillance on them. We could also double down on fiber. Another thing that we could do without any of this technology is monitor the production of short-chain fatty acids in the younger generation. This is a test I often do on my older patients. It's a very simple stool test. But what it does is indirectly tell you about the health of the microbiome, because only good bacteria, the ones that are protective, actually make the short-chain fatty acids, and so they're a good fermentation product. and they're beneficial. In fact, we've talked a little bit about the secondary bile acids a couple of months ago and how those are kind of nasty things that certain bacteria make that are pro-carcinogenic. Well, the short-chain fatty acids are the yin to the yang, so to speak, of the secondary bile acids. So again, you have this kind of dynamic balance taking place, in arm wrestling, if you will, inside your colon to see who wins in terms of the mutations. And a lot of these mutations, this mutational signature concept, is something that we only recently acquired the ability to do. The mutational processes and the geographic change in the number of young people getting colon cancer. Young colon cancer cases are much more aggressive. And part of that has to do with what the gene is that is being triggered here. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about the two forms of hereditary colon cancer. And I want to emphasize that hereditary cancers mean that you inherit the mutation. And the other thing about inherited mutations is they help us identify the genes that are pivotal in certain kinds of cancers. And APC, which is adenomatous polyposis coli, is a very important gene. It is a tumor suppressor gene, meaning that it prevents excess growth. And it's does occur in a hereditary form. And this is called familial adenomatous polyposis, or FAP. This is a condition where people have numerous polyps, adenomatous polyps, which are benign, in the colon and rectum. It's like the growth signal is just turned on. And these mutations can also occur sporadically. So in an older person who's had, let's say, several mutations, the next mutation along the line can be this APC, and it's going to essentially take its foot off the brake and allow for more rapid growth of those tumors. Often it's a setup where it's a 1-2 punch, so to speak. So you have in the case of the younger people, they're getting this APC mutation earlier. They're getting it as young as the age of 5, and so because they are making more, they're growing more and they're growing polyps, and we don't necessarily know they're growing polyps because we aren't looking in young people. And this is one where if we can develop a test for it and start screening, we can really make a difference. And so that was the hopeful end on this story about the colistatin. APC regulates the cell cycle. It prevents excessive cell proliferation. And if it isn't there, you get uncontrolled cell growth. You can also get random mutations occurring. And this is where we're starting to see this mutation cause an earlier rate of cancer in these young people who are showing up with aggressive tumors at earlier and earlier ages. It's interesting, too, because where you get that acquired mutation matters. And I'm not sure if the compounds that are released are I'm not sure if the colibactin actually hits the same spot on the APC gene every time, and the articles that I've read didn't state that. But it is interesting that where these acquired mutations occur make a difference on how aggressive the colon cancer is. So I guess you can be a little bit messed up or a lot messed up. Now we're going to contrast that to Lynch syndrome. Lynch syndrome is the other colon cancer inherited syndrome, but Lynch syndrome doesn't just cause colon cancer. It can be associated with ovarian cancer, a whole bunch of other mutations. a whole bunch of other cancers, and it is a gene repair mutation. So very much like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that you see in the Ashkenazi Jewish population, as well as other certain family lines, you'll see ovary, you'll see uterus, you'll see breast. These cancers are a failure of error correction. And there's 4 or 5 different genes that get mutated in the Lynch syndrome. And this one's called hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer because it's caused by germline mutations. In other words, it's in the ovary, or it's in the sperm, so it's going to go right into the child, and it's going to go right into their ovaries and sperm as they grow up. So one of the things that we see in Lynch syndrome, because it's a defective gene repair, is that you can get other mutations, including APC, the one we just talked about. So what we'll see in that one is a sort of a sudden acceleration of growth of tumors. And this can develop, like you can get a tumor that's not too aggressive, and then it can become much more aggressive. And Lynch syndrome, many people who have this will develop multiple tumors throughout their life because of a failure to properly repair them. So as we understand cancer more, that it's not just a disease, that it's a series of diseases, that it's a bunch of different types of errors that are made, but we've gotten to the point where we can understand it with a granularity that we could pick a target and go after it, like this APC mutation. We could potentially repair that. And that would cure a particular cancer. And could we repair the individual with the familial form? No, probably not. But we could make a huge difference. And as I've said, prevention is even better. So if we can go after the bacteria that makes the cholestatin, then we could find it, eradicate it, and prevent that long-term risk to the individual. And I promised you inherited memory. Well, it's a thing. C. elegans is a small little worm, a nematode, in fact, that is very much the lab rat of the insect world. That and Drosophila. You tend to certain animals for various reasons. As I recall, C. elegans has a very large and easy to read genome, so that makes it useful when you're trying to do research. And it's also easy to grow under laboratory conditions. In this study, the researchers trained these nematodes to associate an attractive odor, which would ordinarily attract them, to stressful starvation conditions. And then they revealed that the associated memory was actually transmitted to the first generation progeny, who showed the odor evoked avoidance behavior. So you train the first ones, the F0 generation, that this smell should be avoided because you'll be uncomfortable and stressed and starving if you stay around it. Then they looked at the babies, and the babies would avoid the odor without ever having been exposed to the adversive stimuli. And then they showed the babies of the babies, and they also exhibited the avoidance, and both the F1, that is to say the children, and the grandchildren, the F2s, exhibited odor-evoked cellular stress responses. So basically they could look at their cells and see a stress response internally. Turns out that sperm, but not eggs, transmitted these cellular stress responses, and it involved methylation of certain loci on the genes, and also the creation of a new small RNA pathway machinery. And it was a serotonin-induced stress response that when they essentially put that smell in them, they got the serotonin release that told them that the animals had inherited, the critters, I guess we could say, had inherited the aversion for this. Now, I'm remembering how we dismissed, when Darwin came around, we sort of abandoned the idea that acquired characteristics could be inherited. And then we learned about epigenetics and methylation and acetylation of the genome and copy number variation. And we realized that, well, it's not just the Mendelian genetics. There's a whole nother layer. And then we found out that, well, some of that non-coding, quote-unquote, junk RNA turned out to be control signals, including, junk DNA, turning out also to code for controlling RNA, like microsatellite RNA, which turns out to be extremely important in the loss of control of cellular growth that we see in cancers, as well as a great many other items of physiology, and very, very weaponizable to begin blocking genes that we don't want to see be made into proteins. And so a whole new type of medical therapy in the form of microinterfering RNA has been emerging in the last few years. So you can see why it would be adaptive, right? A shock or a negative event, and if it isn't lethal, it's at least something you'd want to pass on to your offspring. Lacking language and the ability to have mythology and pass information on in such a way, nature invented a different kind of transgenerational memory. And when you think about humans and the fact that we're ever so much more complicated in some ways, brain-wise, it would seem evident that we would be doing this as well. And the evidence does exist in mice trained to associate an odor with an aversive shock transferred the acquired memory to their descendants, and memory traces were seen even in the great-grandchildren. So it's not just intergenerational, it's transgenerational. Remember, the grandchildren are sitting around in the ovaries and the sperm of the children when they're in utero, because they've already developed those. So at least the stem cells for the sperm are already developed. So you could make an imprint on the grandchildren, but you can't make an imprint on the great-grandchildren. So intergenerational inheritance mechanisms was first established. There's a couple of worms that have learned to avoid certain bacteria. Olfactory imprinting has been established now in moths, in butterflies, in other insects, but we haven't, I don't think, seen, we have seen it in one species of mammal, but the research in mammals is obviously going to take a very long time. Even with mice having an 18-month lifespan, it's still going to take like a 5-year grant to get to great-grandchildren that you can test. So that might be one of the reasons that most of this work is being done in extremely short-lived critters. So let's move to those emails. The first one comes from Charles, and Charles writes, PTTD, and this is posterior tibial tendon disease. I sent an email, but I remembered this site too, and so I sent it to you. Recommendations for treating my tendonitis in the foot, which the sports medicine doctor in Florida said was likely a lifelong condition. It went away for a while in 2017, but returned soon enough and has not receded or advanced at all. A steady presence, manageable but not fun. Thanks for any advice you can give. So let's talk about tibial tendonitis. First of all, any tendonitis, Charles, is literally inflammation chemicals and probably white blood cells of one kind or another in the tendon. So I guess I would frame it as if you had a rope and there was sand in the rope, then the sand would be eroding the rope. And the erosion in this case is not from the physical structure of the sand, but it's from the chemicals that are released by the cells, which are the sand in our metaphor here. And once you get sand in the rope, it's very, very, very difficult to get it out. And that is why tendonitis tends to be a recurrent problem. It is, however, not something that can't be treated, and it doesn't. And there are lots of good strategies, and I'm going to share with you some of them. And the first one to do is recognize which activities are the ones that tend to trigger the tendonitis, and then try to do those activities differently. Running or jumping, for example, in the case of the posterior tibial tendonitis, there may have also been some trauma in the past that has led to scarring, and it may be a tight spot in the tendon, and we'll get to what you might want to do about that. In the case of an acute recurrence or flare-up, a few hours or maybe a few days of ice as soon as possible can help reduce inflammation. I have a couple of acupuncture strategies I do in the case of ligament and tendon strains, which are called the ting points, T-I-N-G, and all acupuncturists know about the ting points. So if you put a single needle in the ting point, right at the base of the nail, that can make a big difference if you can do it acutely within, say, a couple of days of the flare-up. Of course, drugs like over-the-counter non-steroidals are very good. I'm a great fan of topical CBD, especially in, say, the ankle area, because there's not a lot of subcutaneous fat in the skin in that area. So you can, if you just keep rubbing for 30 seconds or so, you can actually get a reasonable amount of the ointment-type oily creams through the skin. So using a CBD ointment, the highest concentration you can find. You'll have to do a little math on the label because of the way they write the labels. But the idea is the highest concentration you can get. And there are non-steroidal products that you can get and that you can rub in. Those are available over the counter at the pharmacy. And they all work reasonably well at reducing that particular kind of inflammation. A type of massage that I really want to emphasize is cross massage. And when people have an elbow tendonitis, I found this is extremely helpful in elbow tendonitis. And if you can stand to do it in the leg, you'll probably derive some benefit. Is you take a paper cup, maybe a small cup like you might find at the stingy doctor's office where they don't want you using all their water, but they want to give you a little bit of water. So it's a tiny little cup, and it's embarrassing to keep going up and filling the cup so people, you know, restrict their use. Anyway, those cups are great because you can it gives you a handle on the ice cube. So you just fill it up, freeze the water in there, and then peel off like half an inch of cup from the top, and then you've got essentially a handle on an ice cube, and you rub across 90 degrees against the tendon hard. And what you're doing is you're mobilizing the soft tissue, but you're doing it in a way that, because you're using ice, it's kind of numbing and you can push harder. And you want to really, essentially, it's like you're almost untwisting the tendon and allowing the sand to drop out of it, or getting, you know, the white blood cells and, more importantly, the chemicals that they release out of there. And this is often used in Asian medicine, Chinese medicine. They use a coin and they rub really hard and they'll give you like a coin hickey. But it is an amazing way to kind of clear out the crap that accumulates in our tendons and our joints. I'm going to talk now about footwear, because this is really important, particularly when we talk about supination or pronation of the foot, because people's, when they put their weight on their foot, often it will rotate in. So if you can get a friend standing barefoot on a hard surface to take a picture from directly behind and directly in front while you've got your weight equally on both sides, look for rotation or twisting or falling inwards on the side that has the tendonitis. And you may see that you could benefit. If you see that, then you want to have corrective footwear. And that would be something like an orthotic that would straighten that out, because you're yanking on that tendon all the time and you want to get rid of that. Both flat feet and high arches can work in against you if there's an asymmetry between the two sides. Now, before you do physical therapy, warming up and stretching, but very careful when I say stretching, you want to do that slowly with no abrupt or what we call ballistic or bouncing stretches. And pay attention to your body. Notice, don't take anti-inflammatories before you exercise. Take them afterwards so that you can know when you're starting to feel pain or feel like it's getting, it's talking to you. In fact, you don't want to wait for pain. You just want to wait for a heightened awareness. And that's when you pop off and put some ice on it and stretch it and massage it. And eventually, you may be able to induce another remission. You probably always have to be careful with it. But I highly recommend against surgical procedures or injections or any kind of invasive thing until you've failed a really solid version of the anti-inflammatory conservative management. If you do get around to getting injections, I think something like platelet-rich plasma is a good place to start. It does not weaken the tendons the way a steroid injection would. And I just think that if there's a new device on the block that's doesn't have, you know, 5 years of track record, unless you're desperate, you probably want to stay away from it. Because again, we were injecting patellar tendons and Achilles tendons with steroids for about 10 years before we realized that it increased the risk of tendon rupture. Took a while for that to emerge. And that's always true when there's a new therapy. Late sequelae, as we call them, aren't apparent until later. And it can take a long time for the bad stuff to show up. Let's go to another email. This person wrote by going to askdrdon.com and hitting the contact us button. And Lloyd writes, rosemary as an adjunct for Alzheimer's treatment, and attaches a link. Rosemary is a spice, a culinary herb, and amongst many of the, you know, rosemary, sage, and thyme, not so much parsley, they're very strong antioxidants and anti-inflammatories. And it's only been really recently that we've begun to understand the biochemistry of this, but one of the really easy ways that you can lower your cancer risk is to actually use culinary spices. Through a variety of mechanisms, they awaken the defensive anti-inflammatory pathways in your body. And in the case of rosemary, it contains a compound called carnosic acid, which is also found in sage. When it gets activated, it stimulates something, a pathway in the cell that's called the NRF2, NRF2 pathway, which is a major control cassette for the antioxidant protein. So basically what happens is that carnosic acid goes to the surface of the cell and it interacts with a receptor, and that receptor triggers the activation and stabilization and release of this NRF2 compound. It's released from a protein which is holding onto it and keeping it from being activated. When you release it, it goes to the nucleus of the cell. And once it gets to the nucleus of the cell, it goes and sits on an area called SMAF and transcribes a bunch of target genes. And these target genes are things for like superoxide dismutase and catalase and glutathione, the master antioxidant, and the two enzymes that reconstitute glutathione. So, I mean, an amazing amount of proteins that then deactivate reactive oxygen species and reactive nitrogen species, which are the things that cause mutation, inflammation, and also are associated with Alzheimer's disease, because it's cell death, right, that causes the Alzheimer's. The problem with purified carnosic acid is it doesn't hang around very quickly in the body. It's highly unstable. So these researchers developed a chemical analog, a prodrug. And you'll be familiar with prodrugs, although you don't know that you are, because, for example, acyclovir, which is a herpes drug that's been around forever, isn't used very much anymore because it doesn't last very long. It has to be taken 3 or 4 times a day. However, if you give valacyclovir, the prodrug, that does not get broken down as quickly in the body. So as it's turned into acyclovir, it does its thing to prevent the herpes outbreak or treat the herpes outbreak, and then is broken down by the body. So you've developed essentially a sort of reserve tank of the drug. By creating this deacetylated molecule, they were able to basically give it orally, and it would be converted into the stomach and absorbed into the bloodstream, and had better pharmacokinetics and better efficacy. So they tested this first in transgenic mice, and these were mice that develop Alzheimer's. So let's be clear, these are mutant mice that have a mutant amyloid protein given to them or into their cellular line, so that they make amyloid that is going to tangle up. They are essentially a model for early onset Alzheimer's, not late onset Alzheimer's, which is probably why many of the drugs that show promise here don't necessarily pan out. This one might, however, be different, because treatment with this reduced astrocytic and microglial inflammation. And we do know that inflammation is what leads to advanced-aged Alzheimer's, the sort of Alzheimer's that hits people in their 70s and 80s. That particular disease is a highly inflammatory disease. And so some people say that the plaque, the amyloid plaque, is actually the scab, and that and we know from recent research that the phosphorylated tau is probably more the causal element here. But nevertheless, an anti-inflammatory like this reduced both the plaque formation of amyloid and the neuritic aggregates of the phosphorylated tau. And so it's safe in toxicity studies and is thus fully suitable for human trials. They did behavioral assessments on the mice, and it improved their memory. And because it's a generally recognized as safe compound, there's a very good chance that this will be developed as a drug in the not-too-distant future, and this one may actually do the trick. Okay, we're going to get a little less sciencey and esoteric and a little more practical. You probably remember over the years being asked if you have an egg allergy before you take the flu vaccine. Well, turns out you don't need to. The FDA in 2025 said that no, you actually don't need to ask about egg allergy. There have been many fairly large studies. In the most recent one, 171 children 24% of whom had had anaphylactic reactions, underwent skin testing with yellow fever vaccine, and then received it regardless of the skin test results with no allergic reactions. And so we don't have to ask about egg allergy for flu or yellow fever or any other vaccines that contain trace amounts of egg protein. So that's nice. Doesn't mean we don't have to have an EpiPen in the pharmacy when we give, or in the medical office when we give vaccinations. It's always a good idea because there's that one in a million thing. But at least it makes us feel a bit better. Let's see, what else have I got here on vaccines? Oh, pneumococcal vaccines are now recommended for all adults over 50. And it used to be very complicated. They've simplified it, and I'm very much in favor of that. There are a lot of disproportionate outbreaks of pneumococcus in people under 65 who have other comorbidities or who are living in under undesirable lifestyle conditions. We've got another comment about that coming up. And so, yeah, I do acknowledge that pneumococcal vaccinations, at least every, you know, couple of times after the age of 50, maybe at 10-year intervals, we have gone through multiple different shifts in what vaccines are available. So we have lots of choices. My general advice is to take the most recent one. These are all developed by the same process. There's no mRNA vaccines here, but they're just capsid coat vaccines. So I really think that the risk of pneumonia certainly validates the, you know, this is a big killer, particularly after influenza. So we really want to get our people vaccinated. Now, there was a warning that came out in January, and I want to spend a little time on this one. This one was talking about the Guillain-Barré syndrome occurring in people who got the RSV vaccines. Now, there's two RSV vaccines out there, one of them AREXVY, I guess, AREXV, and the other one ABRYSVO. I'm going with ABRYSVO. And these are given to people over the age of 65, and there have been an estimated 7 excess cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which I'll describe in a moment, per million doses of the first vaccine and 9 excess cases per million doses of the Abrispo. And it's like, okay, that's pretty much the same. What does it mean? Well, it means that the vaccine is working against RSV, but in doing so, there are people out there who have RSV-like molecules on their spinal cord, and that you're getting an attack on the spinal motor neurons. So this is a polio-like syndrome where people develop paralysis, but no change in their sensory function. And in the case of this GBS syndrome, the paralysis starts at the feet. Typically, people start falling and they have weakness, but it can ascend rapidly. And in extreme cases, people need to be on a ventilator because their diaphragm gets paralyzed from this. It is usually a time-limited disease. Obviously, with modern medical therapy, we have machines that can breathe for the people, and most of the time it doesn't get that dire. How many people die of RSV a year? Well, somewhere between 6,000 to 10,000. So we're talking about 7 excess cases per million doses and a death risk of 6,000 to 10,000. So it's a disproportionate situation where the benefit of the vaccine outweighs the risk of the vaccine. But the 90% of people who get RSV, at a minimum, it's probably more than that, but in the extremes, 90% of people who get RSV survive it, although they may be hospitalized. So I think this is a vaccine that I might wait for if I was a healthy 65-year-old with non-smoking, no lung disease, no heart disease, where I could arguably be able to handle a severe viral illness, and maybe we want a little bit more data on these before we just go wholesale and make it, you know, sort of everybody needs to get this level. Give it time. Let's see what emerges. As I was saying earlier, with the new therapies or the new drug or the new this, that, or the other thing, it's nice to give it a few years for the bugs to shake out of it. My father used to, not that my father bought new cars, but my father used to say something along the lines of, never buy a car the first model year. Wait till they shake the bugs out. Quick one about hypertension. There's been a new revision on the recommendations for what blood pressure to go after. It seems like every 10 years we get a new revision. This one actually causes a calculated 10-year risk that is lower than before. So let's talk about this risk. The criteria that is used for whether we should treat hypertension is whether the calculated 10-year risk of a heart attack is greater than 10%. The new risk calculator is called PREVENT, PREVENT. If you Google or search PREVENT risk calculator, you'll find it, and you can plug in your numbers. And when they did that, what they found is that the new risk factor in a large United States cohort, more than half of the people were reclassified to a lower risk category. And if this were applied broadly across the U.S., about 2.6 million people with hypertension would be initially managed with lifestyle changes alone and not with drugs, because their risk of heart attack would not justify the use of the drugs. So if you're on the fence, or you've been told that you need to be on blood pressure medications, but you're resisting that, might be good to check and see what your actual calculated risks are. I'm going to put this on my desktop and all of my computers and just plug in my patients' numbers. It's easy to do. What this calculator does is it basically points out that the risk to women is substantially lower than the risk to men, sometimes as much as half, particularly for older women. And since older women live longer and have more osteoporosis and are more at risk for falls from antihypertensive medication, this may be an important bifurcation in how a woman is not like a man, and how the recommendations for healthcare for women might not necessarily have to exactly parallel those for men. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.